My name's Chuck B. I'm an alcoholic from Buffalo, New York. Sober by the grace of God and with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous since August the 9th, 1989. I'm a member of the How It Works Men's Discussion Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor, Dave P. My home group and my sponsor are the best home group and best sponsor in all of Buffalo, New York. Actually, all of New York State. Really, all of the East Coast of the United States. Best home group and sponsor in all of the world. And if you don't think that about your sponsor, keep looking. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous allows us an opportunity to learn to connect to another human being and to each other in a very special way. And when I got to AA, I was filled with terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. And as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm filled with patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. I was restless, irritable, and discontented when I didn't have a drink in me. And today I have no alcohol in me, and I'm happy, joyous, and free. And how we get from there to here is an amazing journey. And I'll share a little bit of that, my journey, with you today. This morning, I asked God what he wanted me to do. He said to tell people that he loves us and he cares about us. And if we ask him for help, he'll help us. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a person who had been unable to ask for help in his entire life. It wasn't that I didn't want the help, and it wasn't that I didn't think I was asking for the help. But the reality was that when I was drinking, I was living in full flight from a reality that I had never lived in. So I thought, you knew what I wanted, even though I never told you a thing about what I wanted or needed. I could read your mind, so you could read mine. Now, I'm going to tell you, those tools do not make for a successful life. And they are really the underpinnings of an unmanageable life, a life built on self-centeredness and selfishness, a life built on self-reliance. I have someone calling me here. It's thrown me off. when I came here, I really was a terrified human being. I started drinking as a young teenager in sixth or seventh grade, and you know, alcohol worked for me right away. I'm not very big now, but I was really little then. I was probably about 85 pounds, and I went to a dance, and somebody had some beer, and I went up in the woods, and we drank some beer, and it affected me differently than them. They came down, and they had a good time. Like, I grew up, like, in this time of drinking this beer, I sprouted from this 5-foot-2-inch kid to about 6 foot, and I went from 85 pounds to 185 pounds, and I had never danced a step in my life, and like, I was out there on the dance floor, and I thought everything was wonderful. I got sick that night. I had a blackout. There's a lot I don't remember about it. I woke up the next day just feeling terribly, terribly ill, and I couldn't wait to do this again. I couldn't wait to do it again. Now, that is insanity. When I was in the second grade, I had gone to school, and I had some lunch, and late that night, I broke out into hives. I had a terrible set of hives, and I was itching and scratching, and my mother was trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and she said, asked me, she said, what'd you have for lunch? I said, well, I had tuna noodle casserole for lunch, and she says, well, that must be what causes hives. Now, from that day until this, I have never eaten tuna noodle casserole. And I never will, because I know that that will make me deathly ill. The thought never occurred to me with booze. And yet frequently I got very ill as a result of drinking far too much. But today, I don't have to drink. And I don't have to drink as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went through high school. I did very well in high school. I went to Georgetown University. I did very well in college. I went to Catholic University Law School, and I became a lawyer in 1974. And I did very well in law school. I worked for a couple of years in Washington, D.C., and moved to New York City with a couple of other young lawyers. And we started a law firm. And that firm became very successful. Throughout this entire period, I'm drinking, and by the time I'm a senior in college, I'm starting to use drugs. And all through law school, I use drugs every day. I use drugs every day for 10 years. I am not an addict. When I ran out of money, it never occurred to me to buy drugs. Whenever I got my hands on any money, I bought alcohol with it. I went to the bar, I went to the liquor store, I went to the package store, wherever I went. But it was alcohol that I sought. Now, if somebody had drugs, I used them and overused them, abused them. But I never became an addict. I think if I'd continued, I would have. So there's no doubt in my mind that I'm an alcoholic. The big book says that there are two tests for alcoholism. One, if you try to quit drinking and find you cannot quit entirely, or if you find that when you start drinking, you're unable to stop. I was not a daily drinker. I drank periodically. I was a binge drinker. When I started drinking, I had no idea what was going to happen or no idea what I would do, where I would go, what I would say, who I would end up with, what I would end up with, and most of the time didn't remember what happened while I was drinking. I swore off drinking thousands of times. I don't know how many times I quit drinking. And I could stop, but I couldn't stay stopped. I was unable to quit entirely. So under that first definition, I certainly am an alcoholic. And under the second definition, I'm an alcoholic because when I started drinking, I couldn't stop. I didn't know what was going to happen. And it didn't matter what happened next. I remember I had a major argument in a class action lawsuit in the United States District Court in New York City. And on the way home from work, a number of the lawyers in the firm said, "Let's stop. We'll have a drink and have dinner." And I knew, I remember walking through that door. Right now I'm walking through that door, and I remember saying to myself, "You can't go in there." And I went in. And it was about 6 o'clock. About 8 o'clock, everybody's itching. They want to sit down and have dinner. And I'm thinking, why waste the rest of this good night with dinner? But we, in any event, we sit down and we go to dinner, and I drink all the way through dinner. I had lots of scotch before dinner. I've got some wine now during dinner. Afterwards, I've got some rusty nails. It's about 11 o'clock. Everyone's going home. I'm thinking, well, what's the rush? You know, it's still early. If I just drink till noon, midnight, I'll be fine. I'll get home. I'll get 6 hours of sleep. It's plenty of sleep. No problem. Then at 2 o'clock, I thought, well, you know, it's really not that bad. If I drink like for another half hour, I'll still be able to get 3 or 4 hours of sleep. I'll be fine. And I stumbled into my apartment about 6:30, and I was so drunk I was unable to argue that motion in the federal district court. But that didn't stop me from drinking. It never occurred to me that I shouldn't not drink. On March 5th, 1979, I got a call. I was in the middle of a real tear. I mean, I was on a real tear with my partner, actually. And we had a whole stash of hash and cocaine and scotch and drambuie. We had a lot of beer, and we were on a run. And it was like one of the first weekends of the Big East tournament, He was from Syracuse, and I, of course, was rooting for Georgetown, and so it was a perfectly good reason to celebrate. And it, after the game, we just continued. I mean, why would I stop? Until I get a call on Monday night, March the 5th, 1979, and it's my mother's best friend. She says she's in the hospital with my mother. My father's on the way to the hospital. I better call my partners and tell them that I'm not going to be in the office. And I said, well, why is that? And she said, well, your mother's likely to die. And if you want to see her alive, you better get home as soon as possible. She called me a couple hours later and told me that my mom had passed away. And I was just in the middle of this run, and I just kept it up. And I drank all that day, all that whole week. I drank for the whole week. And it was Friday morning, and they're burying my mom. And I'm sitting in the funeral home, and I say to myself, I got to stay sober today. I can't get drunk. I can't not do this. And I sit back. I'm sort of comfortable with that. And then a thought comes into my head, well, you don't have to stay sober all day, you know. Just get to the funeral breakfast and you'll be fine, you know. After that, that'll be fine. So then I'm sitting there and a thought comes to my head, well, who really cares at the funeral breakfast whether or not, you know, you get drunk? So I thought, okay, I'm just going to stay straight until we bury my mom. Once that's over with, then I'll be all right. Then I'll be able to go out. And, you know, it won't matter. Nobody will care. They'll all be doing their old thing. It won't matter what I do. I sit back and just great relief, you know, thank God, you know, and I sit down and I'm sitting there and I reach in my pocket and I pull out this chunk of black hashish and I bite into this thing and I just start eating and it was right then that I know what I did is I pulled the plug. I disconnected myself from God, from all other human beings, and from myself. And I began living in this soulless world, a world of alcohol and drugs, complete debauchery. In the next 9 months, I would violate more the canon of ethics than I thought was possible to violate. I violated the canons that I promised myself I would never violate. That when I became a lawyer, I said I would never, ever do these things, and I did them, every single one of them. By the grace of God, on December 14th, 1979, I called in all of the employees in the law firm. We had 17 lawyers working for us. We had had offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. There were 35 employees. I called them all in, and I advised them that they were not going to get paid that day. And they weren't going to get paid because there was no money to pay them. But I promised them that we would try very hard to get that money and hopefully they would get paid soon. And I also told them that, by the way, there would be no Christmas bonuses, even though we had promised them to you. You will not get Christmas bonuses. And for those of you who want to stay, the firm is closing on December 31st, 1979. Thank you very much. Merry Christmas. Now, that law firm had started, we were three lawyers, two lawyers and a law student in 1977. We had gained a national reputation and had law students from all over the United States and the best law schools in the United States sending us resumes to interview with our firm and to see if they could come and work for us. That law firm failed for one reason and one reason alone. The managing partner of that firm was an alcoholic. And that managing partner was me. And I had caused the tremendous harm in the lives of all of these people. And not just them, but their children and their spouses and their families, uprooting their careers. Because what I could do is I could drink and think about me. And I could talk about thinking about others, but I couldn't think about others in any way. Over the course of the next year, I kicked around New York City, finally filed personal bankruptcy on November 14th, 1980, moved back to Buffalo, New York in December of 1980. I would not get sober for another 9 years. I completely collapsed. I was unable to work. I was unable to practice law mentally. And it was a grace of God that that happened, because had I continued, I certainly would have done things and would have been disbarred as a lawyer and would not be standing here today speaking on the lawyers and AA panel. But I couldn't practice law. I lost the mental ability to do that. I was able to get licensed by the state of New York to become a social studies teacher. I could think about one thing and do that, but I could not at all. I lost all the abilities that are necessary to practice law successfully. I became an ascetic. I ran away from the world. I said that I didn't want anything anymore. I renounced material possessions. I moved back in with my father. I pushed him away. He left. I lived in this house. I would turn on one light bulb at a time. And I thought that was because I was being ecological. I know today that was happening because that reflected what was going on inside of me, that the light of life inside me was dying. It was very dim. In the course of that process, I met a woman. I got married. She had no idea what was coming. We got divorced in 1989. 1988, I was in psychotherapy, and I had asked my therapist, why do you think I married this woman? My therapist, now mind you, I had built this wonderful case over 2 years, and there was only one answer that he could give me, that she had tricked me, and that it was her who had caused me all of this pain. And he looked at me and in a very calm way, quietly and slowly, says to me, I think the reason that you married her was because that was the only thing in your life you hadn't failed at. And I had failed at that marriage. And so he suggested every session that I should go to AA. I thought he was crazy. But after that statement, I did. I started trying to go to AA in May or June of 1988. And my sober date is August 4th, 1989. I was unable to control alcohol. I was powerless over it. My life was unmanageable. I got to AA. I felt the warmth and comfort in these rooms. I found out that in AA, we all suffer from rectal optitis. It's quite a condition. Our rectum and our optic nerve are crossed, and we feel crappy about life. It gives us a crappy outlook on life. And that described me. You know, I was a negative person. I had this horrible outlook on life, and I felt horrible inside. And I came here in AA, and all of you people breathed in my pain, and God inside you converted that into love, and you breathed back love to me. And that pain that you took from me and that love that you gave back to me gave me the strength to work through these steps. And only by the grace of God and your help have I been able to work through these steps and have that spiritual awakening that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I know that God appears to us when we want and need Him. There was a lot of times in my life I needed God. When my client's wife was talking to me in the bar that night, I needed God to stop me, but I didn't want Him. When I started violating those canons of ethics, I needed God, but I didn't want Him because I knew what the answers were going to be. I knew what He was going to say. But I thought like a child. I was a teenager. I thought one thing, I said another, and I did a third. And so no one could get their hands around me, and I didn't have to worry about attaching to anyone. Bill Wilson says that God appears to us when we need and want Him. That didn't happen to me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I worked these steps. And the way that He appeared to me was in each step He revealed to me His power and His love and His way of life. We get four freedoms in AA. We get freedom from the obsession to drink alcohol. We get that in the first and second steps. We get freedom from the bondage of self when we perform steps 3, 5, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Steps 8 and 9, we're freed from the fear of others. Steps 10 and 11, we're freed from the fear of the hereafter. And we have a spiritual awakening, and what we recognize is God reveals himself to us, and we know that we don't have to improve our relationship with God. That's perfect. But what we can do is improve our awareness of that relationship. And each time that I work the steps, and I work them every year, we have a step action group in Buffalo, New York, and we go through these steps every year. The first Wednesday in September, we start on the first page of the big book, and over the next 40 weeks, we read the entire big book from beginning to end, all of the stories, and we do the steps. We don't talk about doing the steps. We take the actions to do the steps. And when we do that, we get a new spiritual awakening. I can't wait to do the steps. When I start in September, I don't know what's going to happen over the course of that next year. But I know whatever it is, it's going to be something phenomenal. And I don't need to worry about that anymore. When I first took them, I took them with great dread. I didn't want to talk about all of these things that I knew I was going to have to talk about. I was fearful of that. I was filled with fear. But that second step says that we will come to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves that will restore us to sanity. And that happened to me. Through the people in AA, I found out that there was some power greater than alcohol. And there had to be, because they described their relationship with alcohol that was the same as mine. And they weren't drinking, and they said they weren't drinking because they had found this power, and it was this power that stood between them and the drink. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're all Mr. Potato Heads, right? We're 99% potato. We have some different eyes or different ears, a different nose. But we're really all the same people. We know the same pain. We know the same concern. I thought that I would behave the way I did because of the way I drank. What I found out was that I drank the way I did because of the way I behaved. And Bill says that our problem is in our mind, that we're delusional. I was separated from reality. I did not live in a reality that other people, that a normal person lives in. Sanity is when I began to allow that reality into my mind. And that happened by taking these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I identified all of those behaviors that blocked me from a relationship with God. In the second step, I swept away the prejudices. I held the broom and God did the sweeping. He pushed that broom for me and he swept those things away, and I became willing to try to find him. And in the third step, I began a contract with him that ends in the seventh step. And in the third step, I say that, ask him to take away, relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do his will, not so that I may better do things my way without consequences. I ask him to remove my difficulties, those difficulties that are all outlined on page 52 in the book, those bedevilments. I ask him to remove those difficulties so that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help of his power, his love, and his way of life. And that's what he's done. And to the extent that I'm stand here sober today and that I have a meaningful and useful life, it's because of that relationship with God. And that came as he revealed himself. In the fourth step, I identified the emotions, the negative emotions that kept me from him. Anger, fear, and anxiety. And I saw that I created that anger, fear, and anxiety in myself because I stepped on the toes of others and they retaliated. And I forgot that I stepped and I blamed them. And I lived in this vicious circle of excitement, depression, and anxiety. I'd never known any other emotions. But now I do. Now I know love and peace and joy and happiness. As a result of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I think in the end, it's humility that we need more than anything else. My ego is not my amigo. What we need, I had to be brought to my knees sober to see that no matter how much I wanted to change, no matter how much I wanted to do things differently, I could not do that without God's help. And in that sixth step, I finally saw, I want these removed. In the seventh step, he tells me how. If I want these defects of character removed, think of others. I ask him to remove those defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to him and to others. And that's where the freedom comes, from the bondage of self. So I think humility is what this is all about. And I'm going to tell you one story. I was sober 10 years. Things were great. A lot of wonderful things were going on in my life. I'd gotten married in sobriety. I got divorced and then got remarried. I was practicing law with my sponsor and my partner, Dave. Life was wonderful. My wife and I had, we had three kids, two wonderful kids in sobriety. And it's my 10th anniversary. People are calling me. It's just this great day. It's a beautiful August day. I'm going to go to my home group. I can't wait to go there. Having dinner with my 3- and 4-year-old, and the 3-year-old refuses to eat broccoli. She won't eat it. So we say to her, Lydia, you have to eat your broccoli or you're not going to get any dessert. With that, her 4-year-old sister starts crying. So I say to her, Marissa, why are you crying? And she says, well, I'm crying because Lydia's not going to get any dessert. So I told my wife to make sure we remind her about Codependence Anonymous when she was 18 or 19 years old. And she keeps crying, and we get through dinner, and I go upstairs to get ready to go to the meeting, and I come down to go to the meeting, and my wife and the two girls are watching TV. Marissa's still crying. So I give Lydia a kiss goodbye. I give my wife a kiss goodbye. My wife, by the way, is sober 25 years as well. We have a wonderful life in AA. Been really, truly blessed. And it wasn't the 13th step. We were both sober 3 years when we met. So I go to give my daughter Marissa a kiss goodbye, and I bend down to give her a kiss, and I say, give Daddy a kiss, honey. And she says, where are you going, Daddy? And I said, well, I'm going to a meeting. And she says, why do you go to those meetings, Daddy? And I said, so that I can become a better daddy. And she says, well, they're not doing a very good job. God bless you all.
Thank you, Chuck. That was great. And now I'd like to turn it over to Clayton V. from Missouri.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name's Clayton Vandevert, and I'm an alcoholic. You can edit out the last name. I forgot to do that. So that's my first mistake of the day. And there will be many more before we're finished with this. I've been sober since December the 20th, 1987, and I live in a very small town in Missouri, Sykeston, Missouri, and I'm a member of the Sykeston Serenity Group. I am a small-town lawyer. I've been in practice for about 40 years as a solo. I am not an Atticus Finch. You know, that's another variety of small town lawyer. I'm more kind of the Jimmy Stewart type in Anatomy of a Murder, if any of you seen that, which is a wonderful movie about the intersection of alcoholism and the law. I've been trying to think and to do this about what I could possibly share with a bunch of lawyers about lawyers in AA. And I've never attended a lawyers-only meeting. I have nothing against them, but we're lucky to have one meeting in our small town, and it has every variety of human being in it. My sponsor didn't recommend it. He said that I thought I was special enough already and that it would really be unnecessary for me to go to any other specialized meetings. I have also not been able to or not participated in any bar lawyer assistance programs. I spent most of my AA time in doing service work in AA. I don't know how many of you all have read the fourth edition of the Big Book. Now, I know two of you haven't, because you carry around those big books that are got all the notes in them and that have been drugged behind a car. And but in that fourth edition, there is a story called The Perpetual Quest that was written by a lawyer. And in that story, I very closely identified with the lawyer who wrote that story, because like she did, I tried everything in the world except Alcoholics Anonymous to get my life together and to stay sober. She says, many drunks later, I tried everything else I could find. More therapy, different psychiatrists. It was always the next one who would solve my problem. Biofeedback, relaxation exercises, and abuse. Lots of self-help books from Freud to Jung to every current fad that was published or taught. All to no avail, of course, because I'd always end up drunk. And between her and Chuck, y'all have heard my story, because it's exactly the same. So I thought of what I might say today to kind of talk about lawyers in AA, and what I decided was that there are probably a lot of lawyers in this room, but there's probably also people who are not lawyers, who either sponsor lawyers or love lawyers or want to be lawyers or something like that. And so what I thought I would do is I would talk about my observations of myself and lawyers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first observation is that it is no accident that the first three members of AA were a doctor, a salesman, and a lawyer. And I think the reason for this is God took a look around and said, you know, I've got this 12-step program, and if it'll work for these people, it'll work for anyone. So I've made five observations about lawyers in AA that I want to share with you all today. First one is, lawyers love to argue, or as they would put it, explore concepts verbally. There is a movie called Presumed Innocent, which many of you may have seen. And in that movie, the protagonist, who's a lawyer, and his wife and his son are eating breakfast. And the son is standing up, kind of wolfing down his breakfast. And so the lawyer tells his son, don't eat standing up, sit down. The son replies, food goes down easier, it has the help of gravity. The wife and mother says, oh God, we've got another lawyer. Lawyers in AA love to explore those kinds of concepts. The other thing that lawyers have is big egos. And I'm going to tell this one on myself. I've spent the last 4 years being a trustee of AA, and if you look at the list of trustees, and they'll have them somewhere, they're in the conference report, all of the non-alcoholic trustees, the Class A's, have all of their academic credentials behind them. Like the chairman of the General Service Board has FACHE, and the last one, Dr. Ewing, had about 10 initials after his name. And so at one of the meetings of the General Service Board, I was serving with two PhD alcoholics and a couple of lawyer alcoholics. And I said, I think this is unfair. You know, I think that those of us who are alcoholics, we ought to get our initials after our names too. You know, and one of the Class A's who was a judge, Judge Flores, said, get over it, counselor. You will probably not be confronted with self-esteem problems if you sponsor a lawyer. The other thing is, lawyers are experts at gaming the system. Okay? We love for loopholes. Lawyers always read the instructions. If you give me a model airplane to assemble, I will always read the instructions. We do that so that we can find shortcuts. We love to game the system. We enjoy saying things like, you know, maybe, you know, I can kind of skip from maybe 2 to 12. And what my sponsor told me was, he said, I know that you're going to try and figure out how to achieve the benefits of this program without working all the steps. He says, don't try to figure this out. Just do them. The other thing that, about lawyers is that we are experts at not lying, but not telling the truth. We can assemble facts to tell whatever version of the truth you are particularly interested in hearing. Now, the way around this, if you sponsor one or you are married to one, is listen very carefully. Ask a lot of questions. And when you listen, listen for things that are left out. Because those are the things that you need to concentrate on when you're around a lawyer. The other thing about lawyers is we love to negotiate. You know, we love to negotiate. The best lawyer joke I know, and I'm going to tell a lawyer joke, is that, do you know that Moses was a lawyer? Because when he came down from Mount Sinai with the tablets, he told the Israelites, well, I got him down to 10, but adultery's still in there. So, when they're trying to negotiate with you on the fact that, you know, they probably only need, or let me put it this way, would you settle for like 10 steps, you know? Make them do all 12. We'll negotiate our way out of it if we can. The other thing that I learned in this regard about representing lawyers, or came from representing lawyers and representing doctors. And what I found about lawyers who I represented and doctors who I represented, unlike most people I represent who are normal people, is that if you're going to talk to one of those people and you're a sponsor, talk to them as you would a small child. Because if you keep it very, very simple, like do this, don't do that, they can't evade it, and they can't interpret it. I had a doctor that I represented who would do, every time I gave him advice, he would want to explore it. And so what I finally did was end up saying something like, mine is the correct opinion because the state of Missouri has licensed me to give this opinion in the same way that they have licensed you to diagnose jock itch. And if I did it in that way, then he understood what I was saying. So that's kind of my advice on how to deal with lawyers. And I am very sympathetic to those of you who have one in your life. My wife has had one in her life for 15 years. And while she had no part in preparing this, she did a great deal to do with the insights that this may have offered, because I feel every one of these characteristics, and I have learned that through sobriety. So I hope these will give you some tips on dealing with the lawyer in your life and or yourself, and it's been a great privilege to be here, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the convention.
I have a lot of friends here from Pennsylvania and from my other home group in the Florida Keys, and none of them are lawyers. And thank you, Clayton, because now they all know me better. You've told them all my secrets. And as Chuck was talking, I was beginning to have flashbacks of an earlier time. I clearly could identify with his story. I'd like to turn it over to Sydney H. now from California.
My name's Sydney. I'm an alcoholic. And it's really nice to be here at this international convention celebrating 80 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's even nicer not to be handcuffed to a chair in the Carson City, Nevada Police Department, which is what happened the last time I drank vodka in the morning. So, you know, I'm really nervous. And, No matter how many times I get up here and give this share, I get really nervous, which my sponsor's like, well, that would be self-centered fear. But one day, several years ago, I was leaving the house, and my younger daughter, who was probably about 7 or 8, I said, I'm going to go speak at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really nervous. And she goes, what do you talk about? And I said, my life. And she said, well, how hard could that be? It's not like you don't know the story. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I was new and I would hear somebody stand up here and say this, I would be out there, I would feel sorry for them. I mean, and then they would follow it up by, and everything I need to know is in the first 164 pages of the big book, and I'm like, oh, you gotta be kidding me with that. But it's really true. Over time, it's all in there. The solution is in there. When I'm mad, when I'm upset, when somebody's not doing what I think they should do, when I'm depressed, it's the solution is in there. I don't always follow it, but it is in there. So I was born in this great state of Georgia, down the road in Columbus, Georgia. My dad was stationed at Fort Benning. And I grew up in Ponca City, Oklahoma. This accent, you can tell, is not a San Francisco accent. And Ponca City is a small town on the border of Kansas. It's oil and gas and farming. And I'm the oldest of four children. There's no alcoholics anywhere in my family, as far as I know. And, you know, I grew up, my parents were nice, loving, caring people. I sang in the church choir and played the clarinet and the marching band and went to Girl Scouts. And it was pretty much of what you might say a bucolic childhood. But as long as I can remember, I had that feeling, I don't even know the right words, where it was just like dark and hopeless and depressed and sad and bleak. And what I now know from the big book is restless, irritable, and discontent. And there's no reason. That feeling, I was just born that way, and that I came out that way. So my first drink was when I was in grade school. We used to go to this country doctor, and I used to get these coughs. And the country doctor didn't believe in cough syrup. And so she told my mom, when Sydney gets sick, you get the hot water, the honey, the whiskey, and the lemon, and you give that to her. And so that's what we did, and, you know, I kind of liked it when I got that cough. And one day we were camping in Arkansas, and we went to some corner store, and my parents didn't really drink. They drank a little bit, but not really. So we're waiting to get it, and my mom says, okay, I want the smallest and cheapest bottle of whiskey you have. And the guy's like, okay. And she goes, oh, it's not for me. It's for her. So... And then my first sort of illicit drink was sloe gin and cherry 7-Up in the eighth grade, and that was sort of the drink of eighth grade in Ponca City, Oklahoma. But when I was in, I guess, see, girls in Oklahoma at the time, girls could buy 3.2% beer at age 18, but boys could not. They had to be 21, and everything else you bought at age 21 in the liquor store. And so, you know, that was a pretty good deal, especially when you were 16 and you looked 18. But one day we get word of this lawsuit that has been filed by this boy who was mad because he didn't think that was fair, that he had to wait till he was 21. And you know, it didn't take a law degree from Harvard Law School to figure out the court was going to go one way or the other with that. Well, that case ended up, it went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. It's Boren versus State of Oklahoma. And, it was, you know, an equal protection analysis. You have the strict scrutiny and the rational basis. And this is the one that created the intermediate standard of review in gender discrimination cases, that case. Which, so when I was in law school, I was really excited to tell my friends the factual history of this case, but they didn't really care. So I grew up, and I went to college, and I went to law school. I got married. I practiced law for a number of years. I had three children. And so when I came to AA, I would hear these people standing up here, and they would say, I have children, and they have never seen me drink. And I'd sit back there, and I'd think, well, who do they think they are? Bragging? That's just mean. It's hurting my feelings. So I'm like, I'm going to call my sponsor, and she's got 30 years of sobriety, and she's great. And she's going to tell me what I can say to these people so they will stop this. And so she said, get over it and share about it, because that's not your experience, and that's not the experience of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids were 5, 11, and 13 when I got sober. And, you know, I had never heard of living amends, and I'm forever grateful for the concept of living amends, because I will be doing that with them the rest of their lives, because I did everything drunk. I was the drunk soccer mom, the drunk lacrosse, the drunk basketball, the cross country. I would chaperone the school dances, go to the parent-teacher conferences. I did everything drunk. And when I look back on it, it's shameful, but it's a fact, and it's what it is. And what she said is you can share that with another woman, and maybe it will help her. So this went on, the drinking. I drank for 30 years. My sobriety date is February 19th, 2004. And it just, you know, it's just as a long, slow progression, as the book says, into the gates of hell. And so one day, it was a Sunday, and my then husband and my three children had gone to church early because they go to church, they would go to church early because they sang in the choir. And I go down to our home office, and I see this thing, and it's the Smith family, that's his last name, the Smith family reunion. And I'm like, well, what's this? And it's got, well, my mother, my sister, the children's minister, the neighbor, and it's my intervention, and it's planned for the following Friday. So I got drunk and went to church and thought about it. And I really did think, you know what, it's over. So that week I went to the homeopath. I went to the therapist I had seen many years ago, and both of them could not believe I was possibly an alcoholic. I went to the lawyer because I wanted to know the legal consequences of all this, whatever. But, you know, I had an appointment to get my hair cut with this guy that had cut my hair for a number of years, and he had always said in passing, it would always be a part of the story, his membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know whether it was directed towards me. It probably was, because I was probably drunk when I went to get my hair cut. But my point of it is you never know who you tell that you're in AA that 5 years, 10 years later, you're going to be the one that they come to, because I really loved this guy and I trusted him and I was terrified and I didn't know who to turn to and what to do. So he took me in that back room where they do the waxing and all that kind of confidential stuff. And then he got really mean and he said, you're going to go to AA every morning, every day, and you're going to get a sponsor. And I'm like, I'm getting divorced. And he's like, no, you're not going to do anything for the first year of your sobriety. And that, to me, was very good advice. And so I went to my first meeting with him and 100 gay guys in the Castro. And I went to AA every day for 3 weeks. I did call off the intervention. But, well, because the lawyer said if you're not there on Friday, they'll just be there next Friday, so. So I went to AA every day for 3 weeks, and it was President's Weekend, and at my kids' school, they get off the whole week. It's not President's Weekend, it's President's Week, and we would always go to Tahoe with the whole school. Or no, we would go to Yosemite. And there was a lot of drinking, so I'm like, you know what, we're not going to do that. We're going to go see my friend who lives outside of Tahoe. Let's do that for the week, and we'll go skiing. So we go, and you know, I had been to AA for 3 weeks, and I had heard that how it works, that part that says we are not saints, which I thought it was code for we drink a little. So, of course, I never drank a little, but there, all of a sudden, there that car goes. You know, we're almost to my friend's house in Carson City, Nevada. And there it goes, and I get the vodka, and I'm sneaking, drinking the vodka behind the car, and we go to her house the next morning. I start right in, back to the vodka in the morning, and I take my three kids and her daughter up to Incline Village to go skiing. And I don't know what I did that day, but I didn't ski. And so that her daughter called my friend Kay and said, Sydney's drunk, you got to come get us. So all of a sudden, it's 5 o'clock, and there's Kay out of nowhere. And I thought, that's so, what are you doing here? And she's mad, and I can't figure out any of it. And she's like, I'm taking the kids. Oh, and I've lost the keys to the car, of course. And so she takes the keys, and off they go. And there I am at the top of the mountain with no car keys, and it's getting dark, and I'm really drunk. And apparently, I found the keys, and I drove for 8 hours down that mountain. I've driven that many times since then, and it's scary during the day, and it's about a 30-minute drive. And I used to say I didn't have blackouts when I came to AA, but that's not true. I had a huge blackout, and I ended up at some point, I finally found my way down to Carson City and apparently pulled over, parked, turned the car off, and passed out. And then here comes the police. Now, you know, I look like this. I had my little ski outfit on and blue Volvo station wagon. And he thinks that there's something wrong with the car, although it's 2 a.m. And he's shining that big flashlight. And then I start talking to him. And he's like, you're drunk. And I get out to do the field sobriety test, which, you know, that was 10 seconds of that. I'm like, I'm drunk. So he arrests me, and they really do your head like that under the when they put you in the car in the back seat, and oh my God. And so I'm sitting there in the jail, and excuse me, and finally my friend does come at 4 a.m. and bails me out, and I go back, and the next, you know, what an awful thing to do. And my children were terribly worried about me, and so were my friends, and what I put them through is really, it's unforgivable. So the next day, my friend's husband said to me, this is just a blip in the road. And I'm like, are you kidding me? My life is over. It's over. And, you know, little did I know what he said was really true. So then I did go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't have that pink cloud because I didn't get a sponsor, because I was looking for the perfect sponsor. And you know, the perfect sponsor is a woman that would take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So at 4 months sober, that the husband gave me divorce papers. That was a 20-year marriage, and my friends were like, well, that was God doing for you what you could not do for yourself. And then at 6 months, I went back because I didn't have a sponsor and I didn't do the steps. So I was in an intense amount of self-will because I thought that was so unfair that you can get a DUI when your car is parked and off. So we had a trial, and it's called actual physical control. There really is a legal theory about that. But you know, you walk in. So I'm a lawyer, and I don't sit in the defendant's seat. I sit in the lawyer's seat, and that was very humbling. And you go in, and I'm a recycler, so the car was full of bottles. And so there's like those charts. They've blown it up, and they're all over the court, all the big pictures of the bottles. And I mean, it was surreal. It was, and it didn't go so well. And so towards the end, my lawyer says to me, well, you can plead no contest or he's going to find you guilty. Now, if he finds you guilty, we can appeal this thing. And, you know, we have a pretty good chance and all that. So I'm thinking, ooh, I don't want to be known as the Sydney Holler seminal case of actual physical control in the state of Nevada, and it would be a published decision with all those awful, nasty facts. So that was the ego. But, you know, the other part was the serenity. And I said, you know what? You were drinking, and you have been drunk driving for many years, and it's over. It's over. It's time to call it quits and just stop this thing. And so that's what I did. I pled no contest. And I had a note from, I'd been at AA for 6 months by then, and the judge held that up and was like, you know, I was looking at jail time, but I had this letter saying about Alcoholics Anonymous, and so he didn't sentence me to any jail. Thank God. So then I got a sponsor and did the steps, and she said, after I did the four steps, she's like, man, I've never heard so many judges and lawyers on a resentment list. So then I really started doing the deal. And my life got better. It was incrementally, and I really didn't notice it so much, but it did. And, you know, the ups and downs of just a normal life were going along for about 7 years. And then about 4 years ago, my life just imploded all of a sudden out of nowhere. I almost lost my house. My longtime relationship ended. I lost my job. I thought they were calling me in to tell me what a good job I was doing. But it was a grant-funded position, and the judicial branch of the state of California was under some serious financial difficulties, and so there was no more grant. And all through this time, my dad was like, you know, I'm here for you. I'll come out. I'll do whatever you need. And, you know, so I'm talking to him on the phone, and he's in the doctor's office, and he said, hold on just a minute. And then he comes back, and he goes, the doctor says, I look pale and I need to go to the emergency room. And I'm like, Dad, hang up. My bad luck is rubbing off on you. And we laughed, you know, ha ha. And then a week later, he was diagnosed with leukemia, and he didn't want to tell me because he's like, you have too much going on. And I said, Dad, there's only one dad. I mean, I'll get another job and maybe another man in my life, but there's only one dad. And so all through this time, I'm calling my sponsor. The first time she said, now, if I can remember this line in the big book, it's only through work and self-sacrifice for others will we surely survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And then I call her with the next thing, and she's like, this is good. You'll be able to help show a newcomer woman how you can go through hard times and not drink. And I'm like, I'm having some problems here. Can we get some help? And the last time she said, I think you're growing spiritually. And then all those well-intentioned people from AA would say, God's will. God has a plan for you. When one door shuts, another one opens. And then somebody said, but the hallways are a bitch. And I don't think that God, I believe in a loving, kind God that's full of grace. And I don't think God said, I'm going to torture you and see how much can you, I'm only giving you as much as you can take. But I did feel, what I felt was God's presence and God saying to me, I'm here with you and I'm with you and my love and grace is with you. And bad things happen for no reason. They just do. And for us, the important thing is not to drink and to show another person. Then I can learn from you how you got through a really awful time and you didn't drink. So then I had to go find a job, and that was really hard. And I get this interview, and it's to be a duty judge with the San Francisco Superior Court. I was very excited about that. What you would do is you'd work for the Superior Court, and you would review warrants for probable cause and then also hear bond hearings and those kinds of things. And I would be hired by the San Francisco Superior Court. So my moles told me that there were five people applying, and they had three jobs, so that's pretty good odds. So I get this call at 8 o'clock in the morning of the interview from the head of human relations at the court. And she says, we need to talk about, and I'm like, yeah, I wrote, I have a misdemeanor DUI on my record. She goes, yeah, we were really proud of you for being so honest. But one of the judges that's going to interview you Googled your name and DUI, Carson City, and there's a warrant out for your arrest. And you need to get that taken care of before you come in at 5 o'clock. So I'm like, I said, no. I did the community service and I paid the fine. And she goes, I don't know, but that's, So I call my friends in Carson City, and they're both lawyers, and one of them went down and to the sheriff's office, and he looks it up, and he goes, yeah, there's a warrant for her arrest. And my friend said, what should she do? And he said, well, she needs to turn herself in today. And my friend's like, no. So what had happened is I had not done the DUI school, and I had not done the victim impact course. And so I'm sitting there. So Bob, my friend, says, I'll go talk to the judge and we'll get it quashed. Well, the judge had his house shot out by the criminals the night before, so he was not available to quash my warrant. You can only imagine, I'm sitting on that bench waiting for this interview, and I am hopping mad at that judge because I know which one it was. It's the guy I go to church with, and how dare he do this? And then I'm like, what is wrong with you? You are the one that set this ball in motion. You're the one that did not do the DUI school or the victim impact. And he found out a fact, and you're the one, and without this program, you know, who I wouldn't have looked at my part. So I'm sitting there saying that, you know, that little fears prayer and the third step prayer and the serenity prayer, and oh my goodness. And then the doors open, and you can only imagine going into an interview with the Superior Court judges saying, yes, there is a warrant out for my arrest. And here's what I'm doing to take care of it. I didn't get the job, and I was so mad. But then I found out later that there were three commissioners that had been laid off, and this was kind of a sham interview anyway. So that made me feel better that it really had nothing to do with me. And I got to get that little situation cleared up. So then I get appointed to be on a team of lawyers in a death penalty case by the same judge that heard my DUI trial. And I'm like, so I'm standing there. I go back to Carson City, and I'm standing there, and there's the court here and the jail. They're connected right here. And I called my sponsor, and I said, I'm just having a moment here. This is surreal. To be appointed, there it is, and there this is. And it was really something. So we represented this. He was a young man, 23 years old, for a long time. And then at the end, the prosecutor took the death penalty off the table, and he pled to 10 to life. So after it was over, and this judge that appointed me was not the judge that heard the case. So after it was over, I thought, you know what, I'm going to go talk to that judge. And so I go in there, and he's got his DV calendar, and I give a note to the bailiff and that I want to talk to the judge. And then I get the note back, and well, what do you want to talk about? And then I'm like, a personal matter, and I go back. And so then he has a break from the calendar, and I go up there, and I said, I'm in my business suit and everything. And I said, I just want to say to you, I was a defendant in your court 10 years ago. And his jaw dropped. And I said, yeah, it was a DUI case. And he said, yeah, and you thought it was the worst day of your life, and it was really the best day of your life, wasn't it? And I said, yeah, it was. And then he said, I'm 29 years sober myself. So what I do today is what really kind of what I've always done. I go to meetings, I sponsor women. I go to the Women's Recovery Center, the Salvation Army, and meet with women. I go to the women's jail. I pray. I go to the homeopath, the church, the gym. I practice yoga. It takes a village for this head to stop. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it's such an amazing gift that we have, and it's a program of hope. Thank you.